Hi everyone, Jason here. On May the 14th, Stephen and myself will be appearing with the one and only Mark Lewison at the Pavilion Theatre in Dunleary, Dublin. We're going to be celebrating 60 years of A Hard Day's Night, and we would love you to join us. For tickets, go to paviliontheatre.ie or nothingisrealpod.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to Nothing Is Real, a podcast about the Beatles. Everybody thinks they know the Beatles, but how much do we really know? I'm Jason Carty.
I'm Stephen Cockcroft.
And we're live on tape from Dublin. If I remember it rightly, what they did was they put out 62 to 66 on CD and 67 to 70, and then they did Live at the BBC, and then they did Anthology.
Yeah.
And all those things, you see the return of the Apple logo on records, and the Apple logo returns onto the CDs that EMI put out in the 80s and all that kind of stuff. So
yes.
They're kind of building ahead of steam towards the Anthology.
Yes.
I have very fond memories of the Anthology because that was the one time I got to experience a new Beatles single, and I will defend Free as a Bird to the bitter end, and we've had long...
Jason is a big Jeff Lynne fan. Mm-hmm. I'm not so keen on the production sound on that single, but I actually prefer Real Love as a record, perhaps not as a song, but as I think it's closer to the...
Well, there's a new mix of Real Love that's appeared in the last two or three years, which is I'm not exactly sure how it has come to supplant the other one, but it's an even better thing. It's a fantastic mix.
I don't know anything about why that was done, but I enjoyed that too.
And it done with very little fanfare.
Yeah.
I mean, just suddenly it appeared that it was there and you suddenly hear something different and you think, oh, they've actually changed.
Yes.
Changed it significantly, but no fanfare at all.
Yeah, I was really thrilled with both Free as a Bird and Real Love, personally. And but I know they're not... Jeff Lynne's production wasn't everyone's cup of tea on that. I mean, that drum sound in particular. But it's still the three of them. And they didn't spoil anything.
No.
Which was brilliant to actually achieve all that and not spoil anything. And from my own point of view, they had a little liner notes on the picture bags of those two singles. And they were by me.
Mm.
So it's the new Beatles single. And the last Beatles single that had come out, real Beatles single, was Let It Be.
Mm-hmm.
If you exclude reissues, which I was still at school, just started secondary school. And here's the next one. It's 25 years later and my name's on it. And I was very pleased about that.
I can imagine.
I hadn't realized that. That's amazing.
Yeah. And the Anthology for me was the high watermark of my years with Apple. Mm.
Anthology grew out of this long and winding road that had, as I understand it, had initially Neil Aspinall had started gathering stuff in the early 70s.
70.
And had been putting a warehouse together of clips and securing rights and seeing what was out there and getting best processes.
Mm. With their complete approval. I mean, it was an Apple project that just never happened. In the Beatles' time, it was 1970.
Is there a version of The Long and Winding Road somewhere in a vault? Like, is there an edit?
Yes. Well, even better, it's circulating unofficially.
I haven't seen it, but I know it's circulating.
Oh, there is. I don't maintain in my head the names of all the bootleg labels, but there is a bootleg DVD label that put it out about 3 years ago.
You can
buy it down the marketplace.
Did you see it on as a bootleg, or did you see it prior to as part of the Anthology?
I actually watched it with Neil Aspinall in Apple in 1991, and we just watched it on a little screen. It was Jeff Wonfer, who would go on to direct the Beatles Anthology.
Yeah,
a lovely woman called Nell Burley, who was at Apple, who was at the start of the Anthology, but didn't live to see it through. Neil and me, and we watched it at Apple, and I made notes of the entire content of it, and Neil looked at me and went, what are you making those notes for? And I just need to record what I'm seeing here. All right, what are you going to do with that? Nothing. Don't worry.
To have it.
Yeah.
And that presumably is the version that Harrison would have shown to Eric Idle.
Yes.
I know you're a Ruddles fan.
Big, yes. Big.
So are we.
Yes.
Big Ruddles fan.
Yes.
But was that a specific screening that George arranged that specifically? And
yes, he may have only just been in an office somewhere, but Eric Idle definitely did see Neil's Long and Winding Road in its early edit form.
And can you tell, having seen them both, the Ruddles film, you can see the parallels where he's just lifting...
Yes, yeah, the classic Beatle film clips like from the Merseysound film of Ringo, you know, walking through the hairdressing salon, which becomes Barry walking through the salon in Redditch. Yes, of course, that came from Eric seeing that.
And would George, Ringo, John, Paul, would they have been seeing rough cuts as that was being developed, do you think? Or
I don't know.
It was just a general sort of imprimatur to Neil Aspinall, you do this and you...
I don't actually know in the end why it stalled, because he was certainly working on it. It was Neil's focused project for at least a year, and there were people working on clearing rights and bringing footage in. So a lot of work was done, but Apple in the early 70s was probably a very difficult place to get things through because of Alan Klein, and because it's got four owners, but one of them is disagreeing with the other three quite fundamentally on everything. So it just kind of fell in between the cracks. But the anthology was a brilliant project in every way, I think.
And so when you're getting from 91 to 95 when it comes out, I know Jeff Onefour, I think he had done the Flowers in the Dirt documentary with Paul.
Yeah.
And so he had been brought in to do his piece. And then, it's after that that there's interviews going on and Jules Holland is brought in and all these other...
As I remember it, the first anthology interviews with the Beatles were from 92.
Okay.
And I would love to have been involved in those, but I wasn't. And that was principally because George said he didn't want me to do it. So they had Jules. Not that I would have necessarily been very good at it anyway at that time.
But yeah.
Jules Holland did some. I'm not sure I don't think he did them all, because Bob Smeaton.
I think he did
most
the first
of them.
Raft, and then the whole anthology. I mean, I suppose, like every Beatle fan, I adore the anthology project when it came out. But with hindsight, you can see the compromises between the principals.
Yes.
So it's Jeff Onefour is Paul's man. Jeff Lynne is George's man. Jeff Emmerich is Paul's man. Mm. And you can see them trading. It's almost like children in a playground picking members of a team.
Exactly that.
I'll have him, and you can have.
Yeah. I was Paul's pick.
Yeah.
And I wasn't George's pick.
Yeah.
Yes.
So you don't necessarily end up with the best team.
No.
You end up with a compromise team, and then that sort of possibly feeds through into a compromise project. Anthology, I think, is excellent. But again, partly because of Tune In, you look at it and you think, I want to see more of that, or I want to know more detail about that, or I want that interview to be a little longer or a little deeper. But I just think that the politics fascinates me almost as much as the music. We were having this conversation beforehand about what it says about their personal relationships, and I just think the anthology is a very good example of that trade-off, that compromise. I don't know if Ringo really has any his people involved in that. It was Paul and George
I mean, Ringo had to be happy with the choices, and I think they all knew Jeff Onefour. I don't think it was just Paul, but he probably was Paul's pick. There was a man called Rick Ward who did the design for the anthology, including the albums and CDs and DVDs eventually, and that he was George's pick. So yeah, there were. It was I'll have him, so I'll have him, and I know that George didn't want me on it and argued with Paul about it, and didn't want Jeff Emmerich either. But that was another one that Paul pushed through.
Well, I can understand the Jeff Emmerich. Having read Jeff Emmerich's book, I could understand why George wouldn't. I mean, I was.
Well, Jeff wasn't so anti-George in those days, but it was because he was on the receiving end of a lot of fairly strong assaults, verbal assaults from George that he hit back in his book.
Okay.
Oh, right. Okay.
It started with George, that one.
During the anthology project?
Earlier. Earlier, okay. Yeah. And I mean, I once heard George Harrison really ripping into Jeff Emmerich at George Martin's house to George Martin, and George Martin was going, oh no, you got it all wrong about Jeff's not like that, you know. But George was unshiftable in his opinions. George unshiftable, And one of them was me.
Yes.
And another one was Jeff Emmerich, and they were based on little or nothing.
Yeah.
But they were there, and they could not
they
be
weren't
budged.
Gonna shift. No.
And the anthology sort of has that, once again, Beatles' happy accident of timing, that it comes out at the right time. There's a revival in British music, Britpop at the time.
Mm.
It's still this. When I saw that bounty of stuff coming through on the telly, it's like, well, there was no YouTube. It was just the right time to see all of that stuff. 10 years later would have been too late.
Yes.
And it was perfect timing to get that out. In the production of it, I'm always fascinated by the moments when the three of them are together.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have any experience of being in the same space with the three of them at any point
no.
in time?
No. They were closed sessions, and I certainly wasn't welcome. Even though I was well on the team, I was involved in all aspects of the anthology, but, you know, you still get shut out of the door at certain occasions.
Do you find... I find those bits fascinating to watch with the three of them, particularly when they're... You know that scene where they're sitting in George's garden and Ringo says, I love hanging out with you guys.
Mm.
That bit... gets me in the throat.
Because
I think Ringo is particularly earnest and they're trying to be together and there's certain stuff they just can't get over, it seems.
Mm.
I don't know, do you feel that or do you notice that at that time when you'd see the footage of the three of them?
Yeah. I do. And George and Paul, there's an issue between them, unquestionably, through all the times that they're filmed together for the anthology, and I know that they were arguing as well on those days or having strong disagreements, but I wasn't present, so I don't really know. But
there's another very strange...
It was necessary that they had to do the anthology. They did have to do it.
Well, again, it's this idea of compromise.
Yes.
They each had... George, it was financial, perhaps. Paul...
Mm. Paul loves legacy.
It's a legacy thing, a reclaiming...
Yeah.
Something, perhaps. So they each had, for their own reasons, had to compromise.
They did. And, yes. Yeah, I know one of my favourite memories of the anthology is Paul used to hold Buddy Holly Week parties in London every September, usually on the 7th, which was Buddy's date of birth. And when would this be? 90... Five, probably 95 with the anthology just weeks away, because didn't it debut on television in November?
Yeah.
I think it was November 95, 20th maybe, in my head. And so by September 95, it's almost put to bed by this point. It's right on deadline and they're kind of, it's just finishing off. And I wasn't... there'd been a day, the previous day, Paul and George and Ringo had all been in the anthology edit suite, which was in London West 12 in a little rented place in Wendell Road. And they'd been going through, I think, the final episode, which obviously covered the more difficult part, the breakup. And it dredged everything up for them, because Paul was now seeing what George said about it, and George was now seeing what Paul said about it, and they're both seeing what Ringo said about it, and so on. And that was the day before the Buddy Holly Week party. And at the Buddy Holly Week party, all the anthology production team were there, and I was sitting with them, because we were working together all the time, so I was at the party through Paul's office. But we sat together, and because I was sitting with the anthology team, Paul came over and talked to them. He wasn't talking to me, but I'm just sitting there, and he's reflecting on how it had been the day before, watching the rough cut with George and Ringo, and obviously it had been really tough. And he was emoting to them about, wow, what a really tough day that was yesterday, and bloody hell, God, there were bits that I didn't think we'd get through it, and all the stuff that had obviously come up in conversation that had been private to that room, and I wasn't present. But I was there when he was reflecting on it the next day with the team. And, God, that was a great moment for me. Just to witness Paul saying all that to them.
Yes.
I just happened to be there when he said it.
But as I get older, I realise they're human beings. Like, when I was younger, I was like, oh, why do they? Why can't they just get on? But you just realise when you get older, people fall apart, and it's hard to get over stuff, even with the best will in the world, you know?
I think that it seems to me... we were all aware through the 70s and the 80s and probably into the early 90s when they were disagreeing with one another. You would get Paul disagreeing with Yoko quite openly and her disagreeing with Paul quite openly. And George and Paul obviously had some issues that did come out because we know about them.
Mm.
But it also seems to me that probably from the late 90s, maybe for about the last 20 years, they must have actually had a they've got a policy now that they keep it all private.
Yes.
Because we don't know any of that stuff anymore. We don't know what Paul thinks of Yoko now or vice versa. No. They've obviously made an agreement to keep it quiet. And I think from their point of view, that's quite sensible.
Mm. And this is Apple really actively curating the legacy. Mm. And I suppose one of the things for me is it simply curating the legacy, or is it rewriting history a little bit? And I suppose that's maybe what we're hoping volumes 2 and 3 are going to give us that insight. But after Anthology, then at what point does it start to tip into in your mind? It's a biography. I can build on the research that
there is the issue. I know you've spoken a lot in the past about how George was the main impetus for you to be pushed away from the Beatles organization. Is that's a fair thing to say?
George and then Olivia. Yeah.
But you're still working with Paul because you're involved in Flaming Pie and.
Well, I was working for Paul. I was editing Club Sandwich for Paul.
Yes.
From 91 to 98.
Yes.
And Flaming Pie fell in that period. Mm. And he basically used the Anthology team going forward. I mean, it was still Jeff Wonfer. There was an interview with Paul done for the World Tonight documentary that's me and Jeff Baker interviewing Paul.
Yeah.
You just see the backs of our shoulders. You don't see our faces, but that's us. And he had Rick Ward of the team do the artwork for it. So like a continuation of the Anthology, really. And because I'd done the liner notes on the Anthology CDs, so I did them for Flaming
Pie
as
well.
That's
what I was thinking of, that you're still writing for Paul and you're still in his sleeve notes.
Yes, I was. And went to a session or two and a video shoot or two as well.
But then after that, you write your kind of non-Beatles books. You have your comedy books, your Guide to Comedy and your Benny Hill biography. And I'm wondering, were they purposely for you as a sort of did you do that intentionally to kind of do a non-Beatles thing to clear your head or to get another skill set, or how did you
There were always other things I wanted to write about, and I'd just become this Beatles guy, and of course that's not a problem, but I wanted to do other things as well. And I was writing for Radio Times magazine and pitched to them this idea of a TV comedy encyclopedia, which was ludicrously ambitious and not thought through properly, but ended up being a good book.
Yeah.
And indeed came out twice. So and that led me into doing the biography of Benny Hill.
Mm.
When the Recording Sessions book came out, I went to New York in 1988 and I sat in the office of a man at Crown Publishing who said to me, now you should write the Beatles biography.
Right.
And I was 30 years old and all my books were reference books, factual books. And as far as I was concerned, biography was written by the likes of Hunter Davis or Philip Norman or whoever, you know, any biographer. But not me, because I wrote reference books. And he said, you could do it. And I said, no, I can't. And I think you need to know where you're strong and also where you're not strong in life generally. And certainly in terms of anything you do professionally. So I said no, carried on doing reference books. But by the turn of the century, 12 years later or so, I was in my 40s and had a different, more circumspect view of life and what I could do and what I couldn't do.
Mm-hmm.
And when it was suggested to me that I write a biography of somebody, and being that I'd done this comedy encyclopedia, it should be a comedian, I ended up doing Benny Hill. It wasn't actually my choice to do Benny Hill, but I went along with it.
Mm.
And I really did it to see if I could write biography.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's been told, I've been mentioned as a biographer, but can I actually do it?
Yeah.
So I found that I could. And as soon as I knew that I could, and I enjoyed the task of researching it and then writing your own research into a flowing narrative where you connect everything together, then I knew I had to go back to the Beatles.
Okay. So that's when you say yes, around 2002, 2003, to doing that.
Yeah. That's when the current project took root. Yes.
That's a long run.
Yeah.
And I mean, I've just lived with somebody for 5 years who's done a PhD, and I have a vague idea of, you know, how you collate the information before you even sit down to write. And you are a phenomenally patient person. When people on Twitter are like, when's the book, when's the book? Mm. And the writing's important, but it's all the other stuff is the stuff you have to get right first, isn't it?
Nobody knows what goes into the writing of a book, especially people who don't write books.
Okay.
I mean, they can't have any idea. It's as simple as that, just like you can't understand anybody else's job. And writing books are certainly the way I write them. And the way I write them is the only way I can write them and want to write them, is a long, long process.
Mm. Yeah.
And the first volume took 10 years.
Yeah.
But people didn't know that because it just kind of appeared.
Yes.
And then they want the second one like a year later or 2 years later. It's not possible.
Yeah. But you must realize, I kind of realized after reading Tune In, you go back to a book like The Sessions and, you know, that's not a list book. There is a narrative there. There is a story there. You know, there's great writing in that book as well. You know,
if you say so. I wouldn't say so
okay,
myself.
Okay. Mm. Well, I have a huge personal attachment to The Sessions book as well.
I know people do.
So at which point you feel to write the Tune In books, you're obviously totally separate from Apple at the minute. None of this is sanctioned. None of this is official. And so what does that give you as a researcher and an author then that you couldn't do before?
Well, the number one thing it gives me is independence.
Mm.
There is what I used to call APC, Apple Politically Correct. You have to write in a particular way. I learned it on the anthology project where my liner notes would be read by Derek and then by Neil, and it would be like, you can't say this, you can't say that. And it wouldn't be that I was writing anything inflammatory, but just you have to be aware of equality straight down the line, all four Beatles getting their equal space in the sunshine.
Mm-hmm.
So not that I'm deviating from that now. I'm still trying to be fair and balanced, but it's easier to write about artists if they're not controlling your hand.
Yes.
In any artists of any kind.
And you mentioned last night that Hornsey Road is, you know, like a preview of Volume 3, was what you said to us.
Yeah, a little bit of it, yeah. Mm.
And I'm wondering, you know, the Volume 1 goes up to the end of 62 and the release of Love Me Do.
Mm.
And it must be that the way you look for information changes, because in the first time you're kind of panning for gold trying to find the Beatles, and then once you get past 63 they become the news.
Mm.
And how do you start to even filter or process all of that, because it becomes a tsunami, doesn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. Great difficulty on that one. Great difficulty. I mean, I'm out there trying to, as ever, research everything.
Yeah.
And with the next two volumes, I'm absolutely overwhelmed with everything that I've got to wade through to make sense of, to make a clear narrative from.
And again, fans kind of think, oh, well, there's a certain date and time between volumes 2 and 3, but you're obviously researching it all in one swoop.
Yeah.
And it just...
Yeah, you're just constantly
together.
Out there looking for anything that you can find. And of course, there's a lot of it, and I get offered a lot by people, by complete strangers writing to me, which is always wonderful, but my email inbox is ridiculous at the moment, and hundreds of emails unanswered. It's hard just to keep on top of the managing of a project like this,
yes,
let alone the writing of it.
Yeah.
And again, those who carp on about why it's not coming out, they just don't know.
Yeah.
Do you think that has fallen away? I mean, the carping that people are starting to appreciate?
No,
it's still going. We're still putting you under pressure.
But it is flattering. I mean, it's nice to be talked about, and it would be awful if I was spending all these years writing books that seemingly no one was waiting for. So that is very reassuring, but. But sometimes the negative comments get
down
a bit.
I can see your shoulders drop at that.
Yeah, they do a little bit. But I mean, maybe I shouldn't look. But
It's this idea that in the first volume you're sort of travelling to the north of Scotland and looking at local newspapers, and as Jason said, you're sort of panning for gold and little bits and pieces, and that's fine. But then literally every local newspaper in the world will have a Beatles story in 1964 or 1965. You know,
yes.
The middle of Nowheresville, Arizona, will have something.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost as if you've set the bar so high with Volume 1, not just for other biographers. And I'm not flattering you by saying I don't think any biography I've read since Tune In comes close to that level of research. But you're also setting the bar high for yourself.
Yeah.
With the sheer volume. I mean, I'm trying to get my head around, I'm thinking you could probably write another 6 or 7 volumes.
Mm-hmm.
Just taking each year or each 6 month period at
yes,
a time.
Yes, I could. Yeah. I could. I could easily do that.
Yeah.
There's
you heard it here first. There's going to be,
there's plenty enough material. But yes, I did set the bar high, and to keep it there, I know I've really, Volume 1 was really hard book to write,
mm-hmm.
but I just got my head down and did it. But But it's the next two will be harder.
Yeah.
But it's the point of being a historian. I think maybe, you know, you think of books like Robert A. Caro's series of books on Johnson, which I know you've been compared to before, but we're looking at a historical piece. It's not a rock bio in the traditional sense. It's no. It's there for history. This is the one for the ages. Yes. And that's your aim,
it's,
isn't it?
It's the ultimate in flattery for the Beatles, if only they knew it.
Well, we were talking about this before, and I know I've heard you say, you know, that they met the right person with George Martin as a producer and Brian Epstein as a manager. But with you, they've met the right biographer. Maybe, as you say, they don't know it. But in at the long run, you know, you're cometh the hour. You know, this is
that's
the
very nice piece. Of you to say. I mean, I thank you. Well, that's all I can say to that. Thank you. I mean, I know I'm good at what I do, and I think you do need to know where you're strong, and you need to know where you're not strong, as I said earlier. And I know that I'm good at this job, and it happens to require a set of skills that I happen to have, and that's just the way it is. And it would be nice if they were a bit more open-minded about that. I think they are fortunate to have anyone write their biography in this way, whether it was me or somebody else. But it's different now. Because people have agendas, and I'm someone's agenda.
But I think I think it's a biography that's worthy of the subject, and the subject is worthy of this biography. I mean, I think, as Jason says, it's not. I don't really think of it as being a rock biography. It is. You're a historian rather than a biographer. I think that's really the difference between what you're doing and what every other biographer, whether it's of the Beatles or the Stones or any other band. I mean, it's every other book seems to be just a quick trot through a chronology when you compare it with...
They so deserve this. They really do deserve. They absolutely merit a book like this, which is going to be like 5,000 pages by the time it's done. And I've said this before, but I'll say it again. To me, the Beatles represent truth. With a capital T, I think that they were incredibly true to themselves at the time when they were going through all of this. I know John said things like in the Wenner interview about, you know, the things they had to compromise and put themselves through. But you look at any Beatles interview, you look at any bit of newsreel film, he's obviously remembering certain sharp incidents, moments that he's then enlarging as being representative of a whole period. But you look at the Beatles as they go through the 1960s, and I don't just mean by albums. I mean every little bit of newsreel film, every photograph, every interview they ever gave at any time. They were always being completely true to who they were and doing it their way. And that, for me, is why one of the reasons why they sustain and will continue to sustain, because something that true and that organic and that honest is going to always rise above anything else. And I'm trying to write the book that is that matches that truth in every sense, as the ultimate of compliments to them. Because if you really want to know the Beatles, you need to know them on every level and get the truth on every level. And by that, I don't mean anything as crass as I'm going to be exposing this or that. I mean the truth of the moments that they went through and the whole of the story that they had, that all of those years, much of which was not just within their control, but was people reflecting on them, how they altered other people's lives and so on. But to set that down and to get it as right as possible is something that they deserve. And anyone who reads, ultimately, when the trilogy is finished, anyone who reads it will understand the Beatles in a way that they couldn't get that understanding in any other form. So it's the ultimate compliment to them. And it grieves me that this is not recognized by them, but I can't control other people's thinking.
No.
I can do is be straight.
I mean, do you think, I mean, I would be surprised if at some point, I mean, we sort of got to face the fact that there will come a day when Paul isn't with us and Ringo isn't with us, and but the organization will sustain, it will evolve and prevail, and it will think. But it would be nice to think that perhaps at that point, this becomes recognized by the organization, that the people who are the individuals you're writing about can't see it, but there needs to be maybe a little bit.
I don't know that it's them. I don't know, because Apple is a lot of people. Apple is a number of people who sit on the board, but it's also ultimately four owners still. And I don't know who it is. Actually, I do know who it is, but I'm not saying who it is, that will be ensuring that I'm kept at arm's length. And hopefully that will change in time.
You were saying about the importance of independence, but have you ever had a sense that that people have been told don't speak to Mark Lewis?
Yes. I'm my biggest beef, and I might as well say it, my biggest beef with Apple these days is the cowardice of how they've operated with me, because I had a very strong relationship with Neil Aspinall and with Derek, and was part of 19 projects that made them a lot of money, not just thanks to me, of course, but they wanted my input and valued my expertise enough to hire me and pay me and thank me for my services. But about 3 years ago, I was pursuing, actually it happened three times, I was three different archival inquiries that I was actually pursuing. And in each case, inexplicably, when I thought I'd jumped every last hoop that needed to be jumped in order to gain access, it would suddenly be shut off to me, and with no explanation. And on one of those occasions, somebody, and I won't say who, said to me, "I shouldn't be telling you this, but we've been told not to cooperate with you, and we can't let you see anything." And I went, "Who told you that?" And it was Apple.
Apple.
And I just thought, you bastards. You know, I'm trying to write your book here, and I'm trying to get it as right as possible going to paperwork that no one's ever looked at, and it's going to enhance the telling of this story even better. And you're not letting me see it, and you don't even know what it is you're not letting me see. You don't know anything about what's in that archive. But I'd like to see it so I can write your story better. And so I wrote a challenging email, and I said, "I understand you're blocking me now." And I got a one-line dismissal back from my email, and I just thought, right, now I know who I'm dealing with here. But it's so unnecessary. It's so ridiculous. I'm trying to write their story, and they're stopping me.
Yeah.
And I'm someone that they can trust and did trust. Mm. And I'm not some just, you know, bloke they don't know.
Well, I was going to say, they had that relationship. And is it just that the people with whom you had that relationship, that closeness with Neil and Derek, aren't there anymore, and it's just the organisation has changed?
It doesn't help, because when George took against me, which was just ludicrous, because he charged me with offences I'd never done, I had people like Derek and Neil to go in and defend me. Didn't make any difference, because even Derek and Neil couldn't change his mind on things. But nonetheless, I did have advocates, and I don't have advocates there now.
Yeah.
So, and of course, they're not obliged to be nice to me or use me, but I think they've behaved badly. Mm.
There are a few people that, like Derek Taylor and Neil Aspinall, that are no longer with us, that obviously would be key potential interviewees. Mm. Magic Alex is one. Of those people that are Mal Evans, etc., are there people that you were able to interview before they passed away? You know, Neil, for example, or Derek?
Neil, but not enough. Mm. Derek, yes, but not for this project, but I did interview him a few times. Magic Alex, well, I mean, there's quite a long story attached to that, but the brief bit is that I got in touch with his solicitor, his lawyer, quite a few years ago, and said, "Look, Alex is always portrayed as, you know, he was a fool and a rip-off artist and, you know, a scam merchant." And
a charlatan. We can't use that word.
a charlatan. Okay, you're ahead of me in this tale. But if he wants to put his point of view, I'll listen. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not necessarily going to swallow it all, but I'll listen and I'll give him a fair hearing. And I'm sure there's a second side to the story. And quite apart from anything else, he was around them for a very long time and witnessed to loads of events. So I'll have all those stories from him as well. And I do know somebody, a guy called Peter Doggett, a writer, who did go out and see Alex, not for an interview, but just when Alex was selling a load of stuff through Christie's. Christie's took Peter out to meet him, to be there and have a look at all this stuff and to write the catalogue, basically. And Peter told me in the moment that Alex knows a lot of stuff that is really interesting because he was around them so much. And so he's told quite one-dimensionally, and people attack him who never met him. And I'm not saying he's innocent of any of those things, but I, you know, he will have a side to his story, mm-hmm. and he hadn't ever told it. So I wrote to the solicitor, said, if he ever wants to have a fair hearing, if he wants to put his side of the story with someone who isn't going to judge him but will listen honestly, then I'm the man, and I'll come out to Greece and I'll interview him. And then I entered the Alex world, which was a bit mad. And yes, it's going to happen, and no, it's not going to happen, and yes, it's going to happen, and no, it's not going to happen. And after a couple of years of that, you think, you know. And I would just write another letter to the solicitor, going, "I'm still here, and my offer is still on the table, but time's moving on." And then he got ill and died, mm-hmm. so it never happened.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
And you don't know if he ever wrote something down or committed anything to paper?
I don't know that he did, but that would be unchallenged then. Whereas if I had interviewed him, asking him to qualify things and trying to rationalize what he was saying. And
One of the interesting things that popped up on screen last night at the Hornsey Road was a diary of Mal Evans' diary. Mm. There are a lot of stories that Mal Evans was on the point of publishing his autobiography. He'd written that manuscript, and then I've never read anywhere where that is still sitting somewhere, because it seems to me that there are interviews with Mal Evans. If there was a basic manuscript, there's something there. The raw material is there for a biography or a semi-autobiographical work. Is that manuscript or is that diary something that you have access to? Or
I've had some access to Mal's diaries, but not as much as I would like. I'm working on that.
Okay.
There's a lot of... when you do a book like this, and there's so many different approaches, there's so many different people, and everyone has to be handled sympathetically. Mm. And a lot of time is spent taken on things like that that aren't sitting me.
Yes,
sitting
actually
writing.
Doing that. Yeah.
But the manuscript exists, and I've read that.
Oh. Okay.
And it's as a manuscript now, it wouldn't be good enough.
No.
But as the basis of something, it might.
That's what I was thinking as the core to build something around, because
yes.
he was present.
I know the family have had quite a few approaches from people who want to continue. They want to do something creative in Mal's name, but I think Mal's wife Lily is still around, and she obviously isn't wanting those things to happen.
Okay, and I suppose the other two we can't not mention Jane Asher. She's indicating she's not going to give interviews. She's never.
The situation remains unchanged, as far as I know. What is she, Jane now? 73. So she still has time.
It's quite remarkable, the silence.
It's quite admirable.
Quite dignified.
I think it's great.
Yeah.
I really do. Yes. I mean,
frustrating, but dignified. Yes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I think she's very dignified.
Mm. And what about Yoko, who's, I suppose, the woman in that circle? Is she on your interview list or?
No, I have interviewed Yoko a couple of times, but not for this project. But as you've heard me say many times in other interviews, I'll take anything that anybody said to anybody at any time, if it's good and usable and trustworthy. And so I have all the interviews she's ever done. They just haven't been with me.
Yeah.
And I think now, at what is she now, 86, one probably wouldn't get the kind of detailed responses that I would be looking for.
And I suppose if the interviews are there and you can exercise that sort of challenge function against the other information you have. That's almost better than having somebody at that remove trying to recall detail.
Yes, I mean, the interviews that they've all given, everyone has been interviewed extensively. Mm-hmm. And although a lot of the interviews are bland, they're not all bland. Mm. And although a lot of the questions are tedious, they're not all tedious. And quite often, if I mean, this is true, if you read 1970s interviews with Paul, the impression we always have is that he didn't say anything of substance, but he did.
He did.
Yes.
He did.
Yeah.
He certainly did. And it might be related to, it might be even something that the interviewer isn't asking him, but it's something that, a coal that got raked over that morning before before he came in to do the interview, and he wants to say something. Mm. And there are quite a lot of that.
Paul interviews are interesting, how they evolve over time. His 70s interviews are different to his 80s interviews, and now he has these National Treasure interviews, you know?
Yes.
But I remember, like, in the 80s, he'd be going on talk shows. Particularly, I remember him being on Noel Edmonds and being hugely surly, and he wouldn't be doing any of that now. But he's hiding in plain sight a lot of stuff. People kind of say, oh, we can't, we don't know what he means. You know exactly what he means.
Yes.
He kind of means what he means.
Yeah, exactly. What you've just said, I was having this discussion earlier with Stephen, their insights into the man. How he chooses not to say something is actually interesting to see,
yes,
if you know what I mean, because it gives you an insight into his psyche. And we were talking about one of my pet subjects, which is the Give My Regards to Broad Street film.
Oh, also one of Jason's pet subjects. I can step out of the room at this point, but Jason will take over.
Yes, because quite apart from the content of the film, which is, you know, you can view that however you do, is the fact that he thought of it, he wrote it, and the characters in it come out of his head.
Yeah.
So that's a real insight into the way he thinks, even though he's just writing a fictional script.
Yeah.
His thought processes are visible, and that is interesting.
Hmm.
Quite apart from the content of the film.
Yeah, it's an interesting time, because Broad Street, it's kind of disappeared.
Mm.
And I don't know, should it have disappeared? I think it should be more, we should be able to see it, shouldn't we?
Yes, in the light of all of Paul's back catalogue eventually resurfacing and being reevaluated, Broad Street may yet have its moment.
But there is the grand theory that Broad Street is the barrier between, or the border between, you know, post-Beatles Paul, and then, you know, the kind of the Paul we have today, which is retrospective and touring and all the rest.
Yeah, that really happened. The Paul that we see today, that evolved from 87, 88, 89. The Flowers in the Dirt album is the launch of Paul with his Hofner violin bass.
Yes.
Going out on tour doing Beatles hits.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's been doing that for 30 years now.
Yeah.
Since 89, 30 years of basically a Beatles touring show.
But he's still doing, it's interesting to see how all legacy acts are approaching this, like from, say, Fleetwood Mac saying no music, no new music, just touring. Paul still wants to doing new projects all the time.
Yeah, and Egypt Station being a number one was something that he very much wanted.
Yes, and which he got in the States anyway. Okay, did we have a few sort of outlier questions?
Yes, if we wondered if we could maybe ask you some random questions.
These are things that have picked our brains for a long time.
So one of the we had talked about this earlier, about last night in Hornsey Road, you were talking about the 3-1 Alan Klein split, and I was saying to you that it seemed to me that paralleled what is mentioned in Tune In about the appointment of Brian Epstein, that Paul was sort of holding back or was not keen to move forward with Brian Epstein. And I suppose my question was, is there a direct parallel there, and would in 1969 John and George in particular have been conscious of that parallel?
Yes, I'm sure the answer to that is yes, because John mentioned it in interviews, probably in When, and maybe the one with McCabe and Schoenfeld. Yes, John recognised that you know,
this is a continuation, this is a repeat of what you've done before.
And in the clip of Paul speaking to me, which I play in the Hornsey Road show, where John says, you're always stalling, that is Paul remembering that John did say that, and John did say that because he was remembering back to 1961, which is only, seven and a bit years earlier.
Yeah, yeah.
And also Paul with Brian had said, because Brian initially, I think it was... was it 20% or 15% or whatever it was that Brian was after in the initial contract. Paul was saying, well, you know, let's offer him less. Yes. Not because he's worth less or we're worth more, but because that's what you do in a negotiation.
Yes.
Don't you?
Yeah.
You offer less. And again, he tried to do that with Alan Klein. And Paul and John was going on, you know, not again, basically. So, yes, John did make reference to the fact that he saw the parallel there. But John was someone who would, you know, as Paul says, would jump over the cliff.
Yes.
And Paul would say, you jump and tell me what it's like.
Tell me what it's like, yeah.
And you can see both points of view there. And that is, you know, John jumped in with Klein. Literally, they meet in the Dorchester Hotel on the 27th of January, is it? 1969. And that night in the hotel suite, his letters of authorization are typed and he signs them.
Jeez. Yes. Nothing good happens in the Dorchester, we've learned today.
Oh, right, well, yes. Yeah, ironic then that the meeting was held there again in 1983.
But Paul still has he still sort of, as I understand it, I know Scott Rogers is the guy who looks after him these days, but I think Paul doesn't call him a manager. He still likes to feel unmanaged, isn't that right? There's still a thread of that where he's...
Yeah, the Paul McCartney period that is what we still have today that began in 89, say. He was managed then by a man called Richard Ogden, the only one of Paul's managers I knew that was current, actually, was in his office a lot.
Yeah.
And so I was observing how he managed Paul, and that was a good relationship for a while, but not forever. And then when he left, I don't think Paul has actually had a hands-on manager since then. I think he felt that Paul has always managed his managers. Paul appoints his managers. And now he has an arrangement. I don't know Scott Roger, but it seems to be an arrangement where Scott Roger runs a management company and has several artists.
Yes.
And Paul buys his time, as it were, for whatever he needs from him.
Fair enough.
Management services, but he's not got his feet under the desk at MPL. He's somewhere else.
Yeah.
Okay. One of the things that always intrigued me is the relationship, the continuing relationship with Mona Best after Pete leaves the group. And it's that Lennon sending to Mona Best for the medals to wear on the cover of... was that... I know that there's the Neil Aspinall relationship with Mona Best, but did she remain on reasonably good terms even after Pete left, even after the sort of lawsuits and you know, that Lennon felt able to send someone up to collect those medals? Or is that more an indication of Lennon's personality than the relationship?
Well, it all depends on who you listen to. That one, because Mona never said this, and she died, when did she die, 88 or 91, I can't remember when she died, in that period. She never claimed this. I don't think Pete claims it. I may be wrong, but I don't think Pete claims it. I think it's just a family claim. And I think it was in that book that Pete and Rory and Roe Best did together, In the Beginnings, was it called, about 20 years ago. That made kind of emphasis on the fact that Mona Best's medals were on the Sgt. Pepper cover, and that John had asked for them or something. And that is therefore has fed your knowledge.
That's
the
myth.
So that you're quoting it at me. But all I can tell you is that I had discussed it with Neil, and he said it. And he said it was complete crap.
Right.
That's my Neil impression. Yeah. Complete crap.
Neil seems to have been brilliant.
Yes.
Like absolutely.
Yeah.
Extraordinary.
Yeah, I believe so.
Yeah.
I mean, amazing gatekeeper.
Yes, the best.
Him.
The very best.
And again, that point about the politics, the personal politics, he seems to be the one that could navigate that could keep all of that.
He could.
You know, he was still acting and had a relationship with each of the four of them.
Yeah, he was the Beatles' longest-serving manager, and I know that people think, what do you mean? I mean, they're Brian Epstein, Alan Williams, Brian Epstein, and maybe Alan Klein, if you count that. It wasn't really, he was more business manager. But actually, Neil Aspinall managed them from about 73, 74 to 2007.
Yeah.
And that's a very long time. And that was the hardest management job of all, because they still have collective projects. But they've got four different points of view quite often. And he's trying to somehow balance all of that. And I think he did a brilliant job. But back to the Mona Best thing. When Neil said it was complete crap, He was actually speaking of the claims by his family members. So he was outing his family members as manufacturers of stories to me. Mm-hmm. And I'll go with what he said, okay. Personally.
But Neil's good enough for me.
Neil was still living with the Bests as late as 67.
Oh, right.
Really?
And he told me he just picked up the medals and took them down to London. And okay. That's it. It's nothing to do with Mona. And I don't believe that Mona had any association with them. But I wasn't there, and I may be wrong.
Okay.
But
okay.
That's my impression.
Okay. One of my own theories is that a key point is the she said session, mm-hmm. where Paul, there's a row of some description, and Paul mm-hmm. leaves, and George at this point is sort of helping John to finish that track. Mm. And I can't remember where I read it, but that George had an expectation at that point that he would get a writing credit, or that this might be the start of, you mm. know, that he and John might write, that this was really a sort of a Harrison-Lennon collaboration. And then
a follow-up to Cry for a Shadow.
Yes, and when that and when that didn't happen, that was a sort of bit of scales falling from his eyes, and this sort of coincided with the American tour and Candlestick Park and the Indian music and him putting down the guitar. And but that's if right at the beginning they had said all of the songs will be Lennon, McCartney, Harrison, that would have been fundamentally different in the band, and that a lot of it comes back to those sort of to the writing credit issue.
Yes, I agree with you. I don't have anything to add to that except okay. I want to know where George said that.
I'm trying to think where I read that. It might have been in the Steve Turner 1966 book.
I wonder what his source was.
I will see if I can find that.
I'd like to know that
okay.
one.
Can I ask you a question on behalf of my niece? She yes. asked me this question a few years ago, and I couldn't. She was 7 at the time, and she said, is the yellow submarine on which the Beatles live the same yellow submarine as in Thunderbirds?
No.
She'd be so disappointed.
No, I've looked into that to see which came first. And the Beatles came first.
Oh, right. Because yeah. I was telling her, well, possibly, because I thought Yellow Submarine, the writing of that came slightly after the first appearance of Thunderbird 4, but maybe.
No.
But she was.
I remember looking into it and finding that there was no correlation, but...
But then I was thinking, did Paul have a colour television in 1966?
Britain had no colour television yeah. until 1967.
So he wouldn't have known it was a yellow submarine.
No,
anyway.
Not necessarily. But I have found a book that Paul may well have seen that has a yellow submarine on the front cover.
Oh, okay.
That does predate the song.
Hmm.
So there possibly he saw that book cover.
Okay. I'll let her know.
Yeah.
I'll let her know.
Let her down yes. gently.
Yes. Yeah. As far as I know, I have looked into that, and in my mind, I concluded that it wasn't possible.
I just remember being
I have to see my notes to
taken aback that the 7-year-old had made the connection and yeah. was asking me a question I couldn't.
It's brilliant.
I couldn't answer.
And what a great song "Yellow Submarine" is.
Yes,
so brave to do that and to put it out as a single as well, and the immediacy of that record. It came out on August the 5th. And the English football season, as it usually does, it begins around August the 12th, that kind of second weekend in August. And at the first Chelsea home match, all the fans at the Shed were singing "We All Live in a Blue Submarine." And it had been out 1 week.
Wow.
And that's the Beatles. I mean, they're just direct mainlining into the culture.
Yeah.
Is that a single that you remember as a child, that
no,
specifically?
No, actually I don't. I don't, no.
Why not? And the other question...
But the song was around immediately.
Yes.
There's an episode of Tirudhyatha Stupart shot that Christmas, or shown that Christmas, called Till Closing Time Do Us Part, and it's set in a pub, mm-hmm. and they're all having a sing-along, a Cockney pub, and they're singing Yellow Submarine. And God, you know, Paul McCartney.
How fast.
But that is an amazing
Paul McCartney,
thing.
How incredible is that?
Yeah. About the Lennon-McCartney songbook is how... I know they talk about another Lennon and McCartney original, you know, early on in their career, but how it does get co-opted into light entertainment and all forms of showbiz in a way that none of their contemporaries were doing.
Yes.
You know, on BBC Saturday evening shows.
Yes.
It's really striking when, you know, BBC Four pull out all these, you know, old clips, and these songs were just, they would just tip them into the culture and everybody would go fly with them.
1965, I think it was, there was a light end show called the Roy Castle Show.
Roy Castle. I remember Record Breakers.
Record Breakers. Well, there was a feature one week, a Beatle ballet with a ballerina from Covent Garden dancing a Beatle ballet to specially recorded music for that. Well, it came out on an EP, actually, in a nice picture sleeve with her dancing on the cover. And that bit of ballet music, I think it's All My Loving, I might be getting this wrong, but a bit of that music anyway ended up in Magical Mystery Tour.
Oh,
okay.
Mm, the Beatle Cracker Suite, it was called.
Interesting.
And you just think, yeah, incredible. I mean, it's being danced as a ballet.
Yeah.
And these days, we're quite used to crossover, but in those days, they kind of almost originated crossover.
It is that cross-generational appeal.
Yeah.
Which I think almost from 63 all the way up probably until Sgt. Pepper was the tipping point where suddenly the grandparents and the parents were thinking, this is a little bit strange. But one of the things I remember discussing, I think maybe with Piers Hemmingson, was this idea that in America, the generation gap opened up incredibly quickly in that sort of from 64 to 67. And obviously there was Vietnam and there was the draft and there were a lot of other factors that weren't applicable. But that in Britain, I was saying possibly it didn't open quite as quickly as it could have done because the Beatles had that cross-generational appeal.
Yeah.
You know, there was even on Sgt. Pepper, there's When I'm 64, there's something for there's the granny music, there's something for the old people, there's something for the kids. And it's really Magical Mystery Tour, I suppose, when they start to get very dark and very strange.
But even there, Fool on the Hill and Your Mother Should Know are two songs of great
appeal. There's still that
to all
nod
generations.
But that's the point at which. And the other very interesting thing from Hornsey Road last night was we were saying about how there was a sort of a backlash, or there was a how low the Beatles standing was. You know, the Daily Mail were saying what happened, what's going wrong, and various newspapers, and you just gave us that one as the example. I hadn't really appreciated, that was something new to me last night, was sort of appreciating just how they stood. We look back now and I remember my father, when I brought home a copy of Sometime in New York City, and he was absolutely scathing and about John and Yoko and bed-ins and I thought, well, that didn't seem odd to me that you would do that, have a bed in, or you would. But clearly, that was a huge issue.
It was the bed in was about peace, and the general reaction to it was a violent one.
Mm. Yes, yeah.
And John noticed that.
Yeah,
and he, to his enormous credit, just carried on.
Yeah,
didn't let it derail him.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's ask about the Ballad of John and Yoko. Because this is another thing, obviously me and Stephen have fantastically interesting conversations, but you talked last night about John and Yoko being one word, indivisible, all together in 1969. Was Yoko at the Ballad of John and Yoko session? Do we know?
There's no knowledge of that.
Yeah.
I mean, what do we have? There are no photographs of that session.
Yeah.
And she's not audible on the tape.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I just sat and listened to all of the January 1969 tapes, and apart from some times when they jammed together, the Yoko's there the whole time and you hardly hear her. She was perfectly capable of just sitting there quietly. She would knit or read or do something.
Yeah.
So she may have been there. All we have is the session tape.
Yes.
And she's not audible on the tape, but she may have been in the control room.
I love the Ballad of John and Yoko because I think it changes the 1969 story quite specifically, that one day, that one song, because you can kind of see a way of how they could have worked going forward, you know.
Yes.
Let's just do the show right here kind of thing. And
when you consider all their differences by April 69, their ability to still come together and record like that. And incidentally, there's a follow-up to that. In the first draft of Hornsey Road, which ran about 5 hours, I covered all
that's
of
the Hamburg
this.
Version where you had to perform it for 5 hours a night.
I know. Yeah, with prelis. I had a feature on You Know My Name, Look Up the Number, which is 2 weeks after Ballad of John and Yoko. And again, it's just John and Paul, the Nurk twins, as I call them, as they called themselves. And that is a great session, the 30th of April, 69. The Ballad of John and Yoko is the 14th, and this is the 30th. And it's, again, just the two of them having a brilliant time in the studio, despite everything that goes on outside it.
Yeah,
I don't know if Yoko was there for that. Probably she was at both, because they weren't apart at this time. But without a photograph and without hearing her, we just can't know.
Fair enough.
I know you don't like doing what ifs.
Correct.
Uh-oh. But you said that you were in sort of 79, you'd offered Sean O'Mahony this sort of monthly
current news
and what's going on. And Jason is much too young to remember 1979, but my memory of late 79 was the Beatles reunion rumours and Campuchia and all of that coming. And I have a very vivid memory of reading in Melody Maker on NME a review of the Campuchia concert, and they were very scathing about the fact that Lennon hadn't turned up and that. But
knocked for not being somewhere.
Yes, knocked for not being there. But Graham Thompson's biography of George, he mentions that George and Ringo were lined up to do that. But once the rumour started, they backed off. Is that, I had never read that specifically, that they were, you know, I knew that the public wanted them, the press were baying for it, but that they, is that something you're aware of?
I've no inside track on that. It's a Graham Thompson, having researched it, will know more about that than me. So I will go with his research on that one if he's done that properly, and I'm sure he has. I was at that concert. It was Hammersmith Odeon. It was the last days of 1979, around the 28th or 29th of December.
It was my birthday, 29th of December.
29th, okay. Happy birthday. Did you get my card? And it was the United Nations. It was for UNICEF, wasn't it? It was Kurt Waldheim.
That's it.
It was for the boat people of Kampuchea, who were refugees. And all these all-star concerts were arranged by Harvey Goldsmith. Actually, I did interview Harvey about it, and he didn't say anything about George or Ringo. But the rumour was that it would be a Beatles reunion, and tickets were hot that night. I had a face value ticket bought through the box office, but a good friend of mine paid £40, I think it may have even been £50, outside the theatre just to get in that night. And that was when £50 was a very significant sum of money. It was like, how much? Because the face value of the ticket was £2 or £3.
Yeah.
And right into the night, we still expected them to come on. We didn't know that they wouldn't. And in the end, we got Rockestra, which was the only time it was ever done on stage. Yeah, and it was good. And that Rockestra had a lot of good names in it. I remember Robert Plant was playing Paul's Hofner bass.
Yes, I've seen that. That was the photograph on the cover of the NME or Melody Maker, I think.
Plant. And it was the first time I'd ever seen the Hofner bass, because Paul toured through the 70s. He didn't get out the Hofner bass until he decided to become Beatle Paul again in 89. But that's his prerogative. It's his guitar. He can use it. But that was a conscious thing. When he started using the Hofner bass again, you knew that it was changing now. And so Robert Plant was playing that. It was a great lineup. John Bonham, I think, was on drums, and everybody was up there. But it wasn't.
It wasn't the
John, George, and Ringo, and it was actually a disappointing gig, and wasn't one of Wings' better gigs.
It was
either.
Wings' last gig, wasn't it?
Last ever.
Yes, and it was technically not good.
Yeah,
he had to restart a song once, maybe even twice, and there were gremlins, and it wasn't a happy gig.
Yeah.
Too much pressure, I think.
Yeah.
And Billy Connolly was there. He was the MC, and he kept saying, "They're all here. They're all here. The Applejacks. They're all here." Which led us on into thinking they really were there.
And they opened, I think, with "Got to Get You Into My Life."
Yes.
So that would, again, I imagine the crowd were suddenly thinking.
Well, it was the Wing. It was the set that Wings had just done on that tour, which I'd seen a couple of shows, four shows, I think, by then of that tour. And so he was doing a little bit more Beatles, and he also did 20 Flight Rock on that tour, which was the best thing for me.
But I think it's also in the Graham Thompson book, doesn't he suggest that John went to see Monty Python in California in 1980?
This is
the Hollywood Bowl.
Yeah, this is the Keith Badman book after the Beatles breakup, and he has on the 28th of September 1980 John doing his final Playboy interview. Then he has a haircut. Then he and Yoko get on a jet, fly to LA, see Monty Python at the Hollywood Bowl, meet Derek Taylor, George, and Olivia. George gives John a copy of Somewhere in England, which would have been the pre-rejected version, and then they fly back again, and it's never mentioned anywhere else. But I think everyone else says George didn't speak to John since 74 or 75, something like that, 76.
I don't know when they last saw each other exactly. I would go with the Chip Madinger book on John's activities.
His activity, it's so detailed.
Yeah, it is. And I don't...
I've never seen it anywhere else.
About going
no.
to see the pythons.
No, I've never seen it anywhere else.
And didn't John discuss Fawlty Towers in the Andy Peebles interview?
Yes.
I think he did.
So you would think that would...
And didn't say anything about it.
I've just seen... I think, yeah. It just seemed very odd.
Well, yeah. I've always been curious. You know the SNL story that John and Paul were watching SNL one night and they were threatening to go down. Part of me thinks that that might not have happened because Saturday Night Live was regularly in repeats and reruns. And was it a real thing? You know, is it one of these imagined memories? Is that something that's known to be truly true?
I think it is.
It is truly
true.
Okay.
Yes, April 76. Yeah. Was it? Yes, they were at the Paul was at the Dakota.
Okay.
Probably getting spliffed with John. And in the moment, shall we go?
Yeah,
let's go. And then, you know, they don't go.
Everything kicks in.
But I think it was possible.
Yeah.
I do believe the story is true.
That is a lovely what if.
Yeah.
If they just walked on at the end.
And reclaimed their $800 each from Lorne Michaels. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, look, I know we've covered a lot of things today.
Yeah.
Something we're wondering about is long term, there must be a Mark Lewison archive that you're putting together. And is that something that you've thought about? That obviously has a huge historical worth and value.
Yes, I have thought about it. And I had meant to have done something about it by now, but I still haven't. Mm. I do have an archive. I mean, all Beatle collectors have something, and I don't have... Everybody's collection is different. My collection is information.
Yeah.
My collection is about knowledge, because it's a collection to support my work. And it's an unrivaled collection, I would say.
Yes.
And I don't have much of actual intrinsic value. Pieces of paper that they signed, I don't really have that kind of thing. Mine is a collection of scans, photocopies, photographs of important things. I was always pleased to have a photocopy of a letter. I didn't need to own the original. Mm. Don't have any Beatles autographs still. I'm not interested in them. But I want to know the knowledge. I want the information. And my archive of that is unsurpassed and needs to go somewhere in its entirety, intact, and needs to be available for students and historians, anybody in the future who wants to try and get the Beatles story right. And the Beatles archive is not just the Beatles, it's the whole period, because I have, by collecting everything that they have a connection with, I have so much of everything that belongs to the 50s, 60s and 70s. And it really does need to stay together and be available, but I haven't yet worked out where that's going to be or how it's going to be managed.
Okay.
Okay. I think that was my final question, was about the archive. And if you need someone to come and help you,
we'll help
obviously
you
manage
through
that or digitize that or just listen to the tapes. We'd be happy to do that.
I have an abundance of everything. I mean, absolutely huge amounts of everything. In fact, I've just moved and presently my archive is in storage, and there was a weighing scale on the forklift truck that lifted all my stuff onto its place where it's resting at the moment. And that isn't even all my office, but they told me that it weighed 13.2 tons.
Ooh, wow.
We're all very worried about that archive.
Yeah. You know, so. It must stay together and it must be available. And it must be available in the right spirit, free of charge.
Yes.
To anybody who needs it. And I suppose ultimately it needs to be online, but how something of this magnitude can ever be online would take a team of people years to.
Well, this is what I'm saying. It's in the nature of your work is that of a historian. It's not really a biography. It's more than that, and it's a social history as well.
Yes.
We were saying earlier that the first volume is how the world around them influenced the Beatles, and then the succeeding volumes will inevitably be how the Beatles influenced the world.
Yes.
In turn.
Yes.
So it's an academic resource, really.
It is very much an academic resource. Yeah. Yes, it's not just about, hey, I like the Beatles. It's going to
yes, go and have a look.
Paper. I mean, I have substantial runs of office files for Brian Epstein, and some of that is about the Beatles, and other bits are about Brian and about promoters and managers and clubs in the 60s and the licensing of clubs and really deep level reference material that could satisfy almost infinite variety of inquiries in the future by any kind of applicant.
So you're looking for a university or an academic institution that would...
Probably. And I'd quite like it to stay in the UK.
Sure.
Um, but the money is in America, and it needs money, a project like that, to actually needs. Because I've been to some British university archives where they take on somebody's collection, and mostly they just sit in a back room.
Yeah.
Yes.
And rather, this should be something that is openly embraced and open, just open.
Hmm. Okay. Well, Mark, we cannot thank you enough for coming in and talking to us today.
Have a go. Go on, try.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
It's been absolutely illuminating. And I think on behalf of all fans, we're very lucky to have you. Thank you for everything that you've done over the years. You know, when we started this podcast, we talked about how it's not just fun listening to the Beatles. It's fun reading about the Beatles, finding out about the Beatles, going deeper and deeper all the time. You know, yeah. I think when we started doing this podcast, we wondered, would we start hating the Beatles? And we don't. It just gets deeper and deeper, and you go on and on and on, and it's fascinating.
You can only hate the Beatles if you've got hate in your hearts.
That's a very nice way of putting it. I think you're right. And so on behalf of all the fans, thank you. And thank you for coming in to talk to us today. And we hope you'll be back in Dublin very, very soon.
I will. I'm sure I will. Brilliant. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So, yes, we thank Mark Lewson for coming in to join us today. And that was a fascinating conversation, Stephen, wouldn't you say?
Yes. I never thought we'd have access to Mark Lewson. But yes, fascinating. Absolutely fascinating.
And so we remain online in the normal places. If you want to get in touch with us, we're on Twitter at BeatlesPod. We're on Facebook. Look for the Nothing Is Real Facebook group, and Stephen will let you join. Please leave all your regular reviews and 5-star exclamation points in whatever podcast app that you're using at the minute. But for Nothing Is Real, I'm Jason Carty.
I'm Stephen Cockcroft,
and we will see you next time. Thanks very much.
Thanks for listening to Nothing Is Real. We hope you enjoyed today's episode, and if you did, why not become a member? You'll get access to ad-free content, bonus episodes, and so much more. Follow the link in the show notes, sign up on Acast Plus, or visit our website, nothingisrealpod.com.